You're listening to the WTA Insider Podcast. Ready? Play.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the WTA Insider Podcast. I'm Courtney Nguyen, senior writer for WTA Insider at WTATennis.com, and I'll be your host on this podcast, where we take you closer to the players and all the action on the WTA Tour. Well, that's it. Our off-season, at least when it comes to myself and WTA web editor David Kane, who is joining me on this podcast, our off-season is officially over, and we are back into the swing of things. We've fired up the microphones. We're going to get back onto a regular schedule on the podcast as we begin to look forward to the 2017 season, which is just a few weeks away as we record this. So David and I thought that we would take one last look at the 2016 season, a season that was unexpected on every single level with respect to nearly every single tennis player, honestly, who's in the top 10 and top 20. But one that's going to be a memorable one, I think, that we'll walk away from and really, I don't know, still kind of digest as to how this all happened and all the unexpected storylines that we're able to break through. But before I go into kind of summarizing where we're at, should probably bring in David. Hello, David. Thanks for joining the podcast once again.
Hi, Courtney. I, for one, saw all of this coming.
The Oracle, we call him, around the offices. You know, hindsight's 2020. Maybe we should have seen some of this coming. I don't know. But this time last year, this is where the rankings stood for the top 10. So going into the 2016 season, world number one, Serena Williams. World number two, Simona Halep. Number three, Garbiñe Muguruza. Number four, Maria Sharapova. Number five, Agnieszka Radwańska. Number six, Petra Kvitova. Number seven, Venus Williams. Number eight, Flavia Panetta. Number nine, Lucy Safarova. And number 10, Angelique Kerber. So that was what the top 10 looked like at the start of this season. Now, 11 months later, finishing it up, here's where the top 10 stands at the end of the 2016 season. Number one, obviously, Angelique Kerber breaking through and getting that number one ranking at the U.S. Open. Number two, Serena Williams, who won Wimbledon this year, but Kerber bested her with two majors under her belt. Agnieszka Radwańska at number three, Simona Halep at number four. Number five, Dominika Sabolkova, WTA Finals champion. Number six, Karolina Pliskova. Number seven, Garbiñe Muguruza, the French Open champion. Number eight, Madison Keys. Number nine, Svetlana Kuznetsova. And number 10, Johanna Konta. Two very different looking top 10s at the start of the season and at the end of the season. So let's try and just kind of to break this down. When I read off those two top 10 lists, David, what comes to mind to you? What's kind of your initial reaction?
Well, my initial reaction is just what a year it was for Flavia Panetta. I mean,
you just had to do it.
I had to bring it back.
An oldie but a goodie. The longstanding joke of David Kane somehow finding a way to mention Flavia Panetta, the greatest, single podcast. So well done. I'm glad that you're rounding out the season that way, though. It's good.
Start ending the year on a high, for sure. Flavia and I, both of us. What stands out? Only because I feel like we're going to spend a lot of this podcast talking about her. I won't open with Kerber being the most surprising part. I think the most surprising part is the fact that we have Dominika Sabolkova as a top five player. I think that's definitely, if you asked me, the one big shocker in the rankings. I think that would be the most surprising. And maybe the second most surprising thing would be Johanna Konta rounding out the top 10. I think those two things were certainly very shocking. But otherwise, when you look at the top 10, it's certainly 10 very talented women who we all know are capable of playing great tennis. Now, did we think that we would see maybe Svetlana Kuznetsova back in the top 10? Maybe not. Or Madison Keys, maybe a little soon for her to be in the top 10. Or the surges we saw from Garbiñe Muguruza or Karolina Pliskova winning slams, making slam finals. But certainly this was all within these players' respective wheelhouses. So I think the biggest surprise was definitely the way Domi played through the season and certainly ended it on a really clean arc, narratively speaking, you know, conquering a lot of those mental demons and winning the WTA finals in Singapore.
Most definitely. And especially with Dominika Sabolkova, led the tour in titles, taking home 4 titles this year. I don't know. I just don't think that these are some of the stats that we really saw coming, especially from a Sabalkova who obviously, you know, was coming off of a fairly serious heel surgery last season and was still just getting things back and was ranked number 38 going into the 2016 season. So to finish top 5, winning 4 titles and the biggest title of her career, the WTA Finals, pretty impressive. And really, you know, and we'll talk about this in a couple of weeks, setting herself up for what could be a very interesting 2017 as she becomes a player that we kind of look to bring these results, you know, week in, week out, which maybe we didn't necessarily have those expectations of Domi coming into the season.
Especially the way she started the season. I mean, 2 of the biggest matches for her at the start of the year were those really tough losses in Indian Wells and Miami to Radvanska, where she had a match point, and then against Garbiñe Muguruza in Miami, where she led by a break in the third. I mean, those 2 losses were really stunning for me as one who had kind of grown up seeing Domi win those tough matches as the underdog. She got tough seeds early in those tournaments. You really thought that she'd be the one to break those brackets open. And when she didn't get it done, I was definitely concerned for her future. And as she revealed later on in the season, so was she. And it's why she decided to play Katowice before the clay court season. It's sort of one of those anachronistic tournaments, being on an indoor hard court right before clay. It seemed like an interesting decision for one who usually follows the tour and plays the major events on the surfaces that they're played on. But there was so much about getting that match play in, and we saw how it sort of rewarded her immediately, winning the title in Katowice and then making the final in Madrid, and that certainly teed her up for the rest of the season.
More so to me than Domi being in the top 5, Konta being rounding out the top 10 is really the big surprise. I mean, definitely not a player that we thought or you know, had shown. Obviously, she had that great run to finish last year, you know, going on that winning streak over the summer at the ITFs and doing well, you know, once she got onto the WTA side of things. But still, just to be able to bring that level of consistency, won her first WTA title at Stanford this year, beating Venus Williams there. And she got some good quality wins, you know, throughout the year. And so for her to start the season off to a great surprise, obviously, with, you know, making the Australian Open semifinals, and, you know, but to really continue that through, really fantastic. And again, you know, a player who started the season at number 48, finishes at number 10, really remarkable stuff. But I think the other thing that stands out to me when I look at these two, you know, top 10 lists is something that you brought up, you know, offline before we hopped on the podcast, is just that the numbers, these year-end numbers of the top 10 this year, they don't really tell the story of their seasons. You know, obviously, it probably tells a story with respect to Angie Kerber. But outside of that, these have been very roller coaster up and down seasons. Like, if I were to look at a Madison Keys and see that she finishes the year number 8, my initial gut instinct would be, oh, then she must have, what, did she make like a slam semifinal or a slam final? Or did she win a slam? I mean, though, you know, I would think that she got a big result somewhere big, you know, to boost her ranking. But actually, the way that she did it was through consistency, which is something that Madison wasn't particularly known for before. So that's quite surprising. Muguruza, she drops, right, a few ranking points, goes in at number 3, comes out and finishes the season at number 7. Oh, was it, you know, a bit of an off season? Well, I mean, she won a slam, so it's not a bad season, as Garbiñe Muguruza would say, but the consistency outside of that definitely was lacking. I think almost half of her points are that French Open title. So she has a little over, I think, 4,000 points. So 2,000 of those come from Paris. So, you know, that's opportunity for her in 2017. There's not going to be a lot of places that she needs to defend outside of Roland Garros. And again, with the Pliskova, slumped for most of the season, really was a non-entity, and then absolutely surged at the end. So it's kind of funny. I mean, it's a hard top 10 to kind of get your hands around in terms of, you know, their paths to where they ended up. All were very, very different and somewhat unexpected.
Yeah, there really is more than meets the eye when it comes to the 2016 season. Certainly with Muguruza, I'm sure she would be, if you told her at the end of 2015 that she'd finish 2016 ranked number 7 with a French Open title, I think she'd certainly take that Faustian sort of deal. I think, you know, to have that on your resume, it certainly is. It's an investment that tends to pay off for players. Certainly one as talented as Muguruza and one who won the French Open the way that she did, playing such dominant tennis and defeating Serena Williams in the final. I think that's experience that you just can't buy. And so I think the consistency will always be an issue for her. Just, I think that's something that we're going to see over the next couple of years. I think this generation of players, the last two generations, I would say, sort of struggle with that, being that week in, week out consistency that we were so used to seeing in the 80s and the 90s from the Chris Everts and the Martinez and the Steffies, and even in Hingis Davenport in the early 2000s. It's just a different, it's a different game. And it's something we, it's something that forces us to moderate our own expectations. Where do we look at a Muguruza season and call it disappointing because she underperformed at so many tournaments? Or do we look at it as a success because she defeated the then reigning world number one, Serena Williams, to win the French Open? I think that's, I think that the pro certainly outweighs some of the cons in 2016. And also looking at even a Simona Halep, who drops two spots, but certainly ends 2016 more positively than she started it. You know, even though she went down two spots, won another Premier Mandatory, and seems to be getting closer still to the sort of player that people think that she's capable of being, that slam champion, that slam finalist. I think that's something that maybe we can look forward to in 2017. But it's for sure, if you look at the rankings bare, I think it would be very difficult to sort of parse out exactly what went into everyone landing where they did.
You know, we've been talking around her, so let's just go ahead and talk about the player who I think I came up with this list of kind of prompts and questions for David and I to kind of hash over, and we mutually agreed, actually, Angelique Kerber is the answer to most of these questions. So we're going to just, let's just get all the Kerber out, you know, on the front end, and we'll try and work in a few other players a little bit later. But the first question that I had was the most important story, the biggest takeaway of the 2016 season. And what can you say that hasn't been said, especially between the two of us on this podcast throughout the year, about Angelique Kerber, who obviously finishes the year at number one, breaks that streak from Serena Williams, who had held the number one spot for 186 weeks, breaking it just with Serena needing one more week to break the record. So Angelique Kerber just kind of served as the Serena stopper throughout the season, obviously doing so first at the Australian Open, and then obviously overtaking her at the for the number one ranking and winning two majors, the US Open and the Aussie. I mean, obviously a fantastic season for Kerber. Still a bit odd at times, simply because she was undoubtedly the most consistent and on the whole most dominant player throughout the 2016 season. I think it's very difficult to argue against that. That being said, so oftentimes, as we've discussed in the podcast before, she found herself getting to big finals and not being able to close out tournaments and, you know, get those big, you know, whether it was the gold medal match at the Olympics or the Cincinnati final, obviously at the WTA finals as well. But obviously, can't complain. three big
titles. At the end of the day, I don't think anyone's going to be knocking on Kerber's door to say, well, you didn't win Cincinnati, Angie. Sorry about it.
Angie Kerber, biggest story of the season and one that I really don't think too many people saw coming.
It is sort of an odd resume, certainly compiling stats at the end of the year, just seeing how many finals she made and compare that to how many titles she won, you know, certainly making far more finals than she ended up winning. But the three that she won, I think she would, if she had to hand pick three, I think she, those were the three that she probably wanted to win most were the three that she ended up taking home, winning the two slams and then showing that she could play really great tennis in front of her home country after having just won her first Grand Slam final. I mean, I think a close fourth would have been the Olympics. Certainly for any player, you know, that's sort of a dream growing up to win an Olympic gold medal. That's maybe one that she will regret having got away from her, but, you know, having that be sandwiched in between two major triumphs, the world number one ranking, year-end number one. I mean, just so many accolades. Now ITF world champion, you know, just sort of, it's all happening for Angelique Kerber in 2016. And really, it seems to be moving into 2017 with a tremendous amount of momentum.
Yeah, and I'm very interested to kind of catch up with Angie, you know, once the season starts, and also not just with her, but with her coach, Torben Belts, who just to see what their offseason was like, you know, and I know that Torben and Angie were both saying, you know, there are things that she can be better. You know, there are things that we want to tinker on. The serve needs to improve, you know, a few other things. But obviously, we also know that, you know, the off season after you have a breakout season is a very busy one off the court as well. So kind of balancing those two things and going straight into a January where she has Brisbane final points plus Australian Open title points to defend, it's pretty front heavy and she has to hit the ground running. So, you know, it'll be interesting. But I mean, an absolutely unbelievable season from Angelique Kerber in 2016. I genuinely don't know what more I can say about it. I feel like I've been talking about it for a while and I'm just still in awe of it, to be quite honest.
And it's just one of those stories that just shows that, you know, patience, determination, practice. It's really one of those, talk about feel good stories as we looked at the list of things we were going to talk about on this podcast today. Just one of those stories that show the next generation, you know, you may hit the, you know, your forehand a little differently than somebody else. You may serve a little differently. You may act differently on the court. You may look different than some of your peers on the court, even physically. And you can still mold yourself into a champion with hard work, persistence, and determination. And so I think going into 2017, I think that's a message that I think she's probably going to just continue to impart just by being herself and being on the court. She still looks tremendously fit. You know, this certainly isn't somebody who is resting on her laurels in any sense of the word. I think having that mentality where there are still things to improve, I think is the right one to have. And there certainly are things that can be improved. The serve could be better. She can be perhaps more aggressive. The challenge will be balancing that. And I think having that sense of realism that at the end of the day, things are not going to change that much. You know, she's probably never going to have a 125 mile an hour serve. You know, there are certain things off the ground that she's just not going to be able to do because of her technique. And I think, and maintaining that sense of reality will be important. I think, you know, that's sometimes a pitfall of someone who earns some sort of success and feels like they have to change radically. And then there's sometimes perhaps an inner sort of rebellion where they feel like that they don't want to have to change that much. And then there's sort of this gray zone on the court. And I think that will be an interesting thing perhaps we might see on the court. She's someone who's talked throughout the year of adjusting to expectations and feeling like she's gotten used to the role of being a number one player. It's something that she got to experience, I think, in steps throughout the year, you know, first becoming a Grand Slam champion, then becoming number one, then becoming year-end number one. I think things happened for her in such a way where it wasn't too much at once. I think, and certainly as a veteran, one who's been on the tour for so many years, nothing is such a surprise at the end of the day. You're still a player hitting the practice courts, hitting tournaments every week. So I think there's reason to be optimistic that we're going to see a very tough and match-ready Angelique Kerber on the court in 2017.
She likes to work. You know, that has always been, not always, as Angie will admit, but that is, you know, her trademark is that she enjoys the work. She enjoys the practice. She enjoys tournaments and playing matches. And I think that when you have that mentality that the work is a means in and of itself, that it becomes easier to kind of fight against the fluctuations that can sometimes come, you know, mid season or season to season. So I agree with you. I mean, I'm optimistic as to, you know, in terms of where she's going to take things in 2017. But we would be remiss to talk about Kerber and not talk about Serena, because obviously their two storylines are intertwined in a bunch of different ways, although they're obviously, you know, very different in also many different ways. But, you know, whereas Angelique Kerber was playing, you know, not week in, week out, but a pretty heavy schedule for a player who's number one, two-time major champion now. Serena Williams this year, we saw a very marked decrease in terms of her schedule. She played seven tour events plus one event, the Olympics. So eight events in total, which is not a lot. When she played, she was great. You know, she fell short, obviously, a few times. Final at the Australian Open, lost to Kerber. Final of Indian Wells, lost to Azarenka. Lost in the fourth round in Miami. Won Rome for her first title of the year. Lost in the final at the French Open. Won Wimbledon, obviously, to finally catch Steffi Graf. Get that SW22. And then obviously third round Olympics to a Svitolina and semifinals of the U.S. Open to Karolina Pliskova before shutting the season down. So that's where it was. It was an injury-plagued season for Serena. That definitely didn't help things. And it just kind of felt like it was – I didn't there were obviously moments where you saw the best that Serena had. Obviously, Wimbledon obviously is the tournament that where that really stands out. And really, the Australian Open up until the final, she was fantastic, completely dominant. But yeah, I mean, a tough season to gauge for Serena.
I think it's tough sometimes to talk about Serena because a lot of times we end up talking about the ways in which she's perhaps underperformed expectation or is disappointed in some sort of way. I mean, here we're talking about the fact that she had come into Wimbledon making back-to-back slam finals, not winning either the Australian or French Open, and that's sort of being a disappointing year. But I think at the end of the – I think what people have to realize is that Serena is the standard when it comes to women's tennis, and certainly in 2016, and I would guess she will continue to be the standard in 2017 just by virtue of sheer longevity that she's had to the sport. She is a high standard. Yeah, she is the reason why a lot of players who have earned solid results, impressive results, sometimes pale or often pale in comparison to what Serena Williams has accomplished on and off the court. And so looking at 2016, was it a disappointment? Given the fact that she tied Stephanie Graf's record of 22 major titles, I don't think you can call it a disappointment, especially given a lot of the injury struggles that she had in 2016, starting the season under a sort of injury cloud and having struggles even at the U.S. Open, appearing to be injured at the end of her quarterfinal match against Simona Halep and seeming to struggle again in the semifinal against Pliskova. You know, I think and this is a player who we've seen have difficulty when she's on the precipice of these major milestones. You know, we talk about them as if they're no big deal because she's so talented and because she's proven so capable time and time again of stepping through these thresholds. But we saw her struggle to get to 18. It was a difficult hurdle for her to cross. And once she hit it, she really soared and got to 21 really quickly. And then 22 became the quote unquote struggle, even as she was within matches and within sets of tying 22 throughout 2016 up until Wimbledon. So I think heading into 2017, I think there's a clear goal for Serena. I think Serena is a great chaser. She likes to be not the underdog, but the player who has something to prove. And in having a consistent rival in Angelique Kerber, having split two major finals, I think will be a great motivator for Serena heading into 2017. She doesn't have to worry about necessarily 22 anymore. It could be about building her legacy and building records. I don't know if that will continue to I don't think that will continue to bother her now that she's hit 22. I think 22 for everybody is the number to hit. I don't think people talk about 24, and I don't think people should talk about 24, especially that it's not an open era record. So I think heading into 2017, I think we're going to see a strong Serena, and I think we're going to perhaps see the sort of rivalry if Serena is healthy, if Kerber maintains this high level that we've been sort of lacking on the top echelon of the WTA. And I think that would be a really exciting thing to have, especially given their contrast in styles.
Yeah, I would love to see them play more against each other. I think that's one thing that we didn't get in 2016 was enough Kerber versus Serena matches. And even when you talk about, you know, kind of 2016 potentially being a year, especially when we were going into it, we thought that we were going to get like this influx or renewals of rivalries, right? Victoria Azarenka was coming back and she gets that win over Serena at Indian Wells. So you start to think, maybe the Vika Serena, you know, rivalry will get some more. And we had a bit of the, you know, Serena and Sharapova was a bit of a blowout quarterfinals at the Australian Open, but they were kind of clashing as well.
Even Azarenka Sharapova.
Yeah, Azarenka Sharapova
really
as well.
Great matchup.
Exactly. A very good one. And obviously those all fizzled out for a variety of different reasons. But, you know, when you look forward or when you look back, I mean, the big rivalries that we saw throughout the year that kind of defined the season were maybe not the big blockbuster rivalries, right? I mean, Radvanska-Sibulkova is probably a rivalry that really defined this season in a lot of ways when you talk about how important those wins were that each one of them got. Especially, I think, you know, Radvanska's loss to Sibulkova Wimbledon was a gut wrencher for her, given what she had sacrificed to kind of get herself into shape for Wimbledon. So that was problematic. But you know, but on the whole, we really didn't get an explosion of like, okay, these, I mean, I guess Radvanska Wozniacki in the fall, you know, they were playing a lot, but there just wasn't a specific rivalry that you felt like you really were jonesing to see as much as possible. And I feel like, you know, I really wanted to see Serena and Angie, you know, go at it a little bit more this year. We only got those two. They were both great matches, the Australian Open final and the Wimbledon final. Would love to see more of that.
For sure. I mean, especially when you think that Wimbledon was perhaps the better match and it was only straight sets, you know, it was certainly a contrast that we're looking forward to seeing. It's a two high profile players. And I think that that does make a difference. I do think I am happy to see that Radvanska Sibulkova finally got a bit of a spotlight, because it has been one of those sort of hipster rivalries that I think a lot of hardcore tennis fans look forward to, or certainly are excited to see. You know, I don't think it's the match that you look forward. It's never going to be the sort of match where you're wondering if they're going to meet in the same half of the draw before a draw is drawn up. I think that's sort of the difference between a right, Serena Kerber rivalry,
yeah,
and a Radvanska. I mean, maybe it will be, given the fact that they're both top five players now. Hashtag new reality. But I think maybe if we see them maintain as top five players through 2017 and continue to play each other a lot, maybe it will be sort of, it'll become its own top tier rivalry. But I do agree that the more we can get of Kerber and Serena, the more perhaps we can see of some of those other names in some capacity in 2017 and perhaps 2018. I guess that would also be very exciting for the game as well. And then just the next generation and seeing how they add to the mix as well, after a pretty successful 2016 from the group.
Yeah, let's turn and talk about, you know, the younger generation of players who I felt really made a nice surge in the first half of the season. Things kind of tailed off a little bit. But no, we're talking about, you know, Belinda Bencic, Daria Kasatkina, Daria Gavrilova, you know, the young crew of players who maybe not everybody knows quite yet, but they had stacked up some good results in the first half of the season. Second half of the season kind of belonged to a different set of youngsters, you know, Anna Konyu, you know, kind of starting to make good on some of her prodigious talent, doing well at the US Open, beating Radvanska there. You also had towards the end of the season, Naomi Osaka, and really throughout the whole season, pretty consistently Naomi Osaka at the majors. But towards the end of the season, making the Tokyo final, which was pretty impressive for her, especially on ostensibly home soil, which is great. And then you have even, like, you know, other names like the CeCe Bellises and things who are doing well and getting their rankings up and things like that into the top 100. Let's talk about the younger generation for a little bit. I mean, did they surprise you with what they did this year, David? Is this what you would expect of them? You know, did they fall short of what you expected of them? What was kind of your takeaway?
Naomi Osaka's consistency certainly surprised me, especially at the major tournaments. I know she might say, you know, listen, I'm only winning two matches at these slams. It's not a big deal. But the fact of the matter is making the third round at three of the four majors, all three that you played, because she didn't play Wimbledon, is very impressive. And taking that into Tokyo, making the final, I was a little surprised that she didn't take that title home. I really did think that she kind of had the edge against Wozniacki, certainly at the beginning. You know, Wozniacki's fall in and of itself is, or autumn, I guess, not her fall.
There was the fall and then there was the autumn.
Right. And then it was its own storyline, yeah, in and of itself. But I think it's funny because Naomi Osaka, for those who don't remember, won the oft criticized WTA Finals Rising Star tournament, and how that was sort of a silly thing, and perhaps it didn't necessarily showcase the correct coterie of rising stars. And yet the champion of that tournament was Naomi Osaka, and she's certainly a player who continued to rise in 2016 and really had her chances in the US Open, playing on Arthur Ashe against Madison Keys, being up 5-1 in the third against Keys in that match, and really teeing herself up well in 2017 to continue to build on that success. As she said, she did tend to struggle outside the slam, so there are a lot of opportunities for her to continue building up those ranking points. So I think of the youngest set, I think Osaka was perhaps the most surprising. The way Kasatkina played the first half of the season was really surprising, because by Wimbledon, you were looking at her as a player that could she beat five-time Wimbledon champion Venus Williams? You know, this is something that could certainly happen. She beat her in Auckland and had her chances in that really tough third set at Wimbledon where it rained on match point and it was all sorts of drama. And yeah, I mean, just the fact that she played the first half of the season the way she did and getting those really great experiences and really becoming one of those players that you look at as being one who can pull off the upsets and get those big results. Did she carry it through to the end? Not really, but I mean, when she, a player that young, it's hard to hold it against her. And I think that she's going to do some, continue to do some really good work with Vlado Plotanić over the off season. And I think they'll be better prepared for the long haul, I don't think they were as necessarily expecting the level of success in the first half.
She definitely overplayed. And I think that she definitely felt the effects of that by the time the clay season rolled around, which is when she was supposed to, you know, make her big move up the rankings. It's her favorite surface. And she just was sputtering and running on fumes. And so, you know, that, and those are all, that's all learning experience and learning how to put a schedule together. So, you know, it's, I think nothing but positives really to finish that season for Kasatkina. Same with Gavrilova, as you mentioned, Osaka. I think that the only player who, and she is kind of the cream of the crop when you look at the teenagers in the top 100, the only player who really had a frustrating season was Belinda Bencic, who had just injury after injury after injury throughout the season, never was able to get any momentum. And, you know, and again, like, you know, finished her season with more injuries. So, you know, that was definitely disappointing considering that she broke into the top 10, you know, in February for the first time. And, you know, had been coming off obviously an incredibly strong season in 2015. So, you know, one of the question prompts that I had sent over to David was, you know, something that you'd like to leave behind in 2016, not take forward to 17. I would like to leave behind Belinda Bencic's physical injuries and just leave that in this year, purge those, and let Belinda play as injury-free as she possibly can. She's still a professional tennis player, so we know they have their niggles and things like that, but at least to have a nice and clean one. But in 2017, because I think that that did have some impact in kind of the storylines of this year.
I mean, in February, the complexion of the tour looked very different with Belinda Bencic as a top 10 player. And going through a lot of our recap coverage, we had tagged Bencic's match against Yelena Yankovic in Dubai is one of our top matches of the year, and it was certainly a very exciting one, but it was hard not to watch that with a certain amount of nihilism, feeling like, you know, it was one of those results that it was like, to what end did that match serve? I mean, you know, Bencic pretty much dropped off the map after that with her injuries. It wasn't as if Yankovic took that result and had any sort of momentum. She had her own injury struggles. So taking that match in a vacuum was a hard one to swallow, especially after the way she started the season, making the second week in Australia and making the final of St. Petersburg to crack the top 10, become the youngest top 10 entrant since 2009.
But looking back on 2016, David, another question I had for you, the most underrated story of the season. What do you think?
I have a few.
Fire away.
I mean, you'll tell me that I'm crazy, but I don't think we all have taken into consideration or really gave that much thought just how close our one and only Yulia Putintseva was from a French Open final. I don't think we really let that sink in because we didn't think it was possible. None of us believed it in our hearts. But when you look at the results, being just 5 points away from beating Serena Williams, that from potentially playing an injured Kiki Bertens in the semifinal, we could have seen our poots in the final of a Grand Slam. And that's something that happened in 2016.
See,
we didn't dream
that,
it.
But I see it the flip side of, like, it was really close to Kiki Bertens making a French Open final.
No. She was injured. She almost didn't play that semifinal.
She played really well, though.
But do you remember that was a very weird 24 hours because she beat Tomea Baczynski, which nobody thought possible. I mean, I think there were as many people predicting that Baczynski could end up winning that whole French Open, you know, playing Serena on a really heavy clay court, and then a Muguruza, who she, you would think, would have an edge on clay, although Muguruza's had the upper hand in that rivalry. But I think she was certainly a lot of people's dark horse to take on that title. Kiki Bertens wins the match, and then there's some headlines flying around in the Dutch press that Kiki Bertens might not even play the semifinal, that she had injured, I believe it was her left thigh. It was some sort of, she had a calf injury that was perhaps going to keep her from winning that match. I myself was a bit enraptured by the other semifinal at the time with Muguruza and Stoser, the way Muguruza played that. That match certainly foreshadowing the way she played in the final, but the French Open was definitely a weird one. And it certainly juxtaposed nicely against the WTA 125K in Bowl, which was sunny and luxurious and marvelous, as having to cover it on the web team was certainly a treat, because while there were washouts happening in Paris, everything was sunny in Bowl, Croatia. I think we might want to consider bumping that tournament up just a little bit in all of our estimations.
I love it.
That's another underrated story.
It's another Bowl.
Hashtag Super Bowl.
It was the French Open was definitely a weird one. But yes, underrated. Yulia Putintseva, nearly a Grand Slam finalist, ended up finishing the season at number 33. So
another underrated story, and again, I'm just going to tick off all of my boxes for this podcast, would be, of course, the tremendous rise of Elena Vesnina, who started the 2016 season outside the top 100. It was to the point where I believe last fall, because this is the sort of thing that happens to me. So you texted me wanting to know if Elena had been injured, because her ranking had fallen so far. I guess, you know, sort of like the bat signal, you know, like when something happens.
David
to,
is the Elena Vesnina whisperer.
To a certain group of players, that people just come to me and want to know, well, what's going on? And so I remember thinking that there wasn't really anything going on. There just was a string of inconsistent results. And it was the sort of thing, having spoken often to Elena at the US Open and again in Zhuhai, something that was bewildering, but something that she really didn't overly worry about. You know, she took a long vacation at the end of the 2015 season and just kind of gave this, you know, had this optimism that whatever was going to happen would happen. And sure enough, from losing, this is a player who played slam qualies at the Australian Open and then two slams later was a semifinalist. And certainly we do remember the way it ended against Serena, but the run that she had beating Ekaterina Makarova, her doubles partner, a player who she'd only beaten once in 7 or 8 previous encounters. That was not a favorable rivalry for someone to make their first ever Grand Slam quarterfinal, and then crushed future Singapore champion Dominika Sabalkova in the quarters to make that semifinal against Serena, and then really taking that momentum into in qualifying for Zhuhai and then winning the gold medal at the Olympics in doubles and then winning Singapore in doubles as well. And having a little bit of illness and injury issues in Asia, and as someone who is sort of eyeing that top 10 as the next threshold for her in 2017, and really talking about how that might have been in the back of her mind in the fall, and sort of maybe being a little bit grateful that she was a bit under the weather in Asia, that it kind of gave her some time to put things in perspective again, and looking forward to seeing what she can do on the singles and doubles court once more in 2017.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the most underrated stories, and it's obviously a collection of stories of this season, is just the number of really unexpected deep runs that unheralded players had at various tournaments throughout the year. And I just remember so many of them. I mean, it started in Brisbane, Samantha Crawford making, you know, that deep run into Brisbane. What was it? The semifinals? She made the semifinals there. Then you had Jo Konta, Zhang Shuai making their deep runs at the Australian Open. Even Monica Puig making the Sydney final early on. You know, you had a bunch of players who were making these deep runs, and they kind of were like, huh, really? That I didn't really necessarily see that coming. You flash forward. Laura Ziegemann, the final of Stuttgart. That was a run that I don't think many people saw coming. Luisa Chirico, as a qualifier into Madrid, making the semifinals there. You know, you had it over, obviously, Vesnina, Wimbledon, Bertens at the French Open. Even in a lot of ways, you could say Wozniacki at the U.S. Open. I don't think at the start of that tournament, people thought that that was going to be what happened. So
I was going to say Sevastova myself.
Well, that yeah. Well, yeah, no, for
talk
sure.
Talk about a feel-good story. That Anastasia Sevastova, I'm sorry to just totally hijack your Wozniacki plot thread, but the image of Anastasia Sevastova coming into press with a New York Yankee cap on is one that I don't think I'm ever going to forget. She was such a revelation in press, had this really dry sense of humor and really sort of charmed the press room at the US Open. I think joking that she was sort of a D-list celebrity in Latvia and wasn't really certain that even a run to the quarterfinals would aid in helping her rise up the celebrity ranks at home, but really was one of the, again, an unexpected story, especially one who was retired just only 18 months ago.
Yeah, most definitely. And so, you know, there were just a lot of those really kind of surprising, and most of them were like really feel good events. You know, people making these deep runs and you're like, wow, that's great. Like, you know, even, you know, at the time you didn't think twice about it, but like the names that popped to my head are like Patricia Maria Tsig, you know, when the Romanians took over Madrid for basically a week, with Begu also making a deep run there, Sorana Kirstea making a good run there. There was just a lot going on with kind of like unheralded players.
Everywhere, really. Victoria Golubic winning at home in Stad, you know, and there was a
lot of winning. Istanbul,
oh God. Right? Yeah. And kicking off the greatest post trophy ceremony concert in WTA history.
If people can put that on DVD or Blu-ray or Laserdisc and send that to me, you will be forever. I will just love you forever, because the Istanbul Cup had an epic post trophy ceremony concert. It puts Eurovision to shame.
It was Eurovision
at its finest. So, I mean, all of that happens. And then kind of turning to this idea of like feel good stories, which a lot of these that we've obviously mentioned have been feel good stories. But for me, the one that was the feel good story, and again, a player who no one expected to make a deep run, let alone walk away with a gold medal, Monica Puig at the Olympics, doing what she did in such dominating form throughout the week, to go and to win Olympic gold for Puerto Rico, first man or woman to win gold for Puerto Rico. Impressive stuff. It's still, to me, kind of one of those, along with, you know, the Kerber story, and it kind of goes hand in hand with one of the themes that you picked up on early, David, which is, you know, these are stories about people who just kind of put their nose to the grindstone and work. And just, you know, maybe the results that they achieved this year were not ones that people thought they might get, but, you know, they never stop believing. And that says a lot. And I think that for Monica Puig to get what is effectively a career making win, and to do it just the way that she did. And I just know how much playing for Puerto Rico means to Monica. That was just a really incredible result. And I still think that it's underrated. Like, I don't think that within tennis, people understand like kind of the reverberations that win had back home for her.
I think the ranking points might have helped. You know, I think had it been something that, I mean, as it is, she finishes the season ranked pretty high because she had a really good season leading up to the Olympics and even after the Olympics, having a good run in Tokyo. But had she been able to take home, you know, 1,000 points or however many points you got from winning London and Beijing, I think it might have upped people's estimation. But it certainly wasn't just a career making win. It was like a movie making win. I mean, this is something that movies are made of. I mean, and you talk about Monica Puig's sort of, I don't think there's a player who is more open about playing for her country and really having that be sort of a defining characteristic that you will find besides Monica Puig's love of playing for Puerto Rico. I think it's really, you know, week in, week out, tennis is an interesting sport because you do play for your flag every week. It's your country is next to your name, but I don't think people take it or are as open with how seriously they take that as Monica Puig. So to see her win the most nationalist thing you could win in tennis at the Olympics, and not only be the first woman to win a medal for Puerto Rico, but to take home Puerto Rico's first gold medal, man or woman, you know, I think for someone like Puig, it's sort of the best thing that could have ever happened to her. And again, I mean, this is a defining moment in her life, as, you know, talk about it being an A-list celebrity. I mean, the parades, the accolades, the TV appearances, you know, the record-breaking votes, you know, for player of the month on the WTA website.
Yeah, for us, I mean, like, you know, we see it from the analytics side. I mean, Puerto Rico was, they had Pika fever. You know, I mean, they were into it, everything. They were, you know, they were kind of just everything that she touched kind of turned to gold after that. And no pun intended. But yeah, no, I mean, it was still a story that just kind of brings a smile to my face in terms of just being a feel good story, an unexpected story. And
she got the wins, you know, she beat Muguruza, she beat Kerber, you know,
she didn't sneak in and get that, you know, she won it.
Yeah.
Turning to some of our final topics, David, let's get a little emo. Let's get a little sad. What was something that maybe you thought was going to happen this year that didn't happen, or something that was just kind of disappointing to you? Something that you kind of wished, like, ugh, I wish that didn't happen this year. We're talking about on court within the match sphere of things. But what kind of stands out for you?
Things that I thought were going to happen. Well, I mean, I was pretty confident at the end of 2015 that we were going to see sort of a return to stability. I thought we were going to see, you know, that sort of 2014 year in championships for me was sort of that collective. I mean, as chaotic as parts of that year were, when you looked at that top eight, it was a top eight that really made total sense from sort of a January 1 to season end, just like a really cohesive and comprehensive group. And we sort of got a lot more chaos in 2015. We saw a lot of inconsistency. So I really did think we were going to see sort of a return to normalcy in 2016. We didn't really get that. Wasn't really one of my better predictions, but in some ways we did get that. We certainly got the consistency on the biggest stages. We got Angelique Kerber playing three Grand Slam finals. We got Serena playing three Grand Slam finals, two of them against one another. So in some ways the top echelons of the game have gotten the tip top echelons have gotten pretty tight. I think we got a really good mix at the top of the game. We got Kerber breaking through and sort of becoming a stable force at the top of the game. We got a new Grand Slam champion in Muguruza, who's sort of that flashy, aggressive style that I think a lot of fans really respond to, and certainly a lot of writers respond to. I think a lot of people like the sort of tennis that Garbiñe Muguruza plays when she's playing her best. And we got to see a little bit more of history with Serena winning her 22nd Grand Slam title, reciting Maya Angelou's Still I Rise, which is sort of one of those great...
I would still weep if I was watching that.
Hair-raising.
It's such a great video from the BBC.
Really well done. I think everyone kind of had their moments. You know, I mean, even with Petra, you could be disappointed that she didn't play as consistently at the start of the season, but, you know, winning her bronze medal at the Olympics, finishing 2016 on a high. I think everyone kind of had their day when you think about it. Even going into Fed Cup, you know, Barbora Strýcová almost single-handedly leading the Czech Republic to their fifth Fed Cup title in 6 years. I mean, and then even going back to more feel-good stories with, you know, Garcia Mladenovic becoming the first all-French team since 71 to win the French Open. I think at the end of the day, the things that we thought were going to happen but didn't are off court.
Right. Yeah. Like, I mean, when we talk about, you know, Maria Sharapova, obviously making her announcement in March and obviously being off tour until April, that was unexpected. And I'm sure that nobody wanted that to happen or wished that did happen, but it did. Even Victoria Azarenka doing so well at the beginning of the start of the season. And, you know, I think you and I said, you know, at the end of March, this is a player who's going to challenge for number one, and we would expect might be number one, you know, kind of around September or October.
Well, I mean, I think we did think that clay was going to be a little bit of a stopgap
for sure. But it was a stopgap for Kerber too, and she was still able to kind of pull it together. I mean, true. I guess Stuttgart, you're right, fair enough. But, and, you know, yeah, but otherwise. Yeah,
and that was it. and Charleston.
Yeah, Charleston semis, that's right. But yeah, I mean, in terms of, but so, you know, yeah, there's going to be the off-court stuff.
I think the extremes with Azarenka, and I don't think we really got to discuss this formally, are really what are so surprising about her season. But the level of success that she had when she was on the court was so striking. And then contrast that with having to cut her season so short, it was whiplash her season, you know, even throughout the season, you know, roaring into the Australian Open as sort of the de facto favorite in many ways. I think a lot of people were just assuming it was going to be a Vika Serena final. And I think a lot of people were picking Vika to win the title, and then sort of flaming out in spectacular fashion to Kerber in the quarterfinals, stealing her mojo, did Kerber, and then winning the Sunshine Double in Indian Wells in Miami, and then feeling like that was really, especially the way she played in Miami. I mean, there were some struggles in Indian Wells, but I think the way she finished the match against Serena and took that momentum into Miami was certainly making people think that, again, that she was going to be a sort of more consistent force on the tour. I think if things had been steadier in one way or another, I think it would have been less surprising. But just the way that she came and left in 2016 was sort of still sort of jarring. It's something, and it's something that we're not used to. It's the first, you know, talk, leave it to Vika to do something totally unexpected. I, you know, this is not something that we have experience with, you know, with players in what seems to be certainly the prime of their game stepping away. For those who haven't watched, I highly recommend you watch her interview that she gave with Tennis Channel. There's some exquisite B-roll of her walking in slow motion on a beach. And she talks a lot about her her journey, you know, toward motherhood and how she really has played a lot of tennis through her pregnancy. She hasn't played in a couple of weeks and is not putting a tremendous amount of pressure on herself when it comes to the comeback, especially given that she hasn't actually given birth yet. So I think it'll be interesting to see how the timetable lays out. I think she certainly seemed a lot more certain in her initial statements that she'd be back on the tour very soon, you know, after she made her announcement versus this latest video. It does seem like there might be a little bit more of a break, you know, between leaving the tour, having a child, and then maybe or maybe not coming back to tennis.
One thing that I thought that was going to happen in 2016 that ended up not happening is the Olympics having an effect. I was in terms of scheduling, in terms of player fatigue, and on the whole, I'm sure that it did have an effect for the players who did go down. But at the end of the day, it really didn't have that much of an effect. I mean, what we saw was obviously this break in the middle of the summer as the players went down to Rio, but the results remained consistent before the Olympics and after. So it really didn't have a ton of impact outside of the fact that the players who did skip the Olympics, it did help them.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think it hindered anybody, but it certainly gave a marked help to those
who
did
play. Which I thought was going to be the case anyway, but I just really thought that if you were going to play the Olympics, it was really going to have a negative impact on the 2 and 3 weeks after Rio, and that really didn't happen, which is great. I mean, that's what you want to see. It just was counterintuitive, I suppose. I really thought that it was going to have more of an impact.
I mean, at the time I don't know if this ever made it to air, but I talked about Beijing and remembering back in 2008 and how I think all four semifinalists not only played Beijing, but Dementieva and Safina both medaled. So I think, you know, talking about, and that was, I would imagine, an even crazier trip to China, to New York versus to Rio.
We'll flip the script then. Things that did happen in 2016 that you really did not think was going to happen.
One of the things, I mean, it's a funny thing because given how many spots there are, when you think about it, there's 8 quarterfinalists at every slam. And so that's 32 spots in a season. And you do kind of think over the last couple of years that one of those spots might well be taken up by one Svetlana Peronkova. She's sort of one of those streaky, inconsistent, sort of maddening players who's done really well, you know, at very strange times of year at Wimbledon and winning that title in Sydney as a qualifier. So if you asked me to pick a surprise quarterfinalist in 2016, I might have picked her, but I certainly wouldn't have picked her at the French Open. And especially given the draw that she had beating Charleston champion Sloane Stephens, I believe it was one in love. It was like a 50-minute match. And then recovering from a rain-delayed fourth round against Agnieszka Radwanska, where she trailed 6-3, 3-0 at the start of the rain delay to then win the last 6 games of the second set and then win the third and to make the quarterfinals and really kind of had her chances against Sam Stosur in that match. We could have seen her as another surprise semifinalist. That's sort of one of those moments that that I look back on in 2016 that certainly does make me smile.
I love it. Mine is actually mine's a little bit more emo than yours, which is I'm going to read off some names that are currently ranked outside the top 50 to finish this season. We've got Yelena Yankovic at number 54, Andrea Petkovic at number 55, Lucy Safarova at number 62, Anna Ivanovic at number 63. Floating down there, you got Camilla Giorgi down at number 83. I did not think that these players would be ranked outside the top 50 at the end of 2016. I thought that they were kind of top 50 staples at a minimum. So definitely frustrating seasons for each and every one of them for a variety of different reasons. Obviously, Yelena Yankovic had some illness issues. Lucy Safarova coming off of some illness issues. And Anna Ivanovic and Andrea Petkovic just really having a difficult season on the court. And obviously, Anna had great stuff going on off the court with her wedding to Bastian Schweinsteiger, but otherwise a very tough season for those four players. But yeah, I did not think that I would see them at the end of this year outside the top 50.
And then I guess another thing that was that we didn't expect was to see the insane last, 3 weeks from the one and only Svetlana Kuznetsova, who started the season on a high and ended the season on an equally high note, winning the tournament in Sydney and then coming down to the wire at the WTA regular season, winning Moscow. She had to not only win the title, but to defend a title for the first time in her career, got it done, flew to Singapore from Moscow on no sleep and, as we later learned, no haircut, took the court against Agnieszka Radwanska, wins that match, gets it done again against Karolina Pliskova, not only qualifies, but is qualified first in her group and very narrowly makes the final at the WTA finals, and certainly would have given her even odds against Angelique Kerber in that match. Definitely a moment to remember, and certainly not one we thought would happen in Asia. I mean, to tell me she qualified from Asia wouldn't be that surprising, but the fact that it came down to the wire for her, that any one match would have knocked her out of contention, definitely big shocker.
So last two, I'm just going to put them together for you, David, to answer them. What from 2016 would you like to take with you to 2017? And what would you like to very safely leave behind?
What will I take with me? I think I will take the Strzelcowa swagger with me into 2017.
Yes, love that.
Such an underrated player in 2016, Barbara Strzelcowa, making the one of the biggest finals of her career in Dubai, making another final in Birmingham, finishing the season in Zhuhai, and then again, almost single-handedly taking out a very strong and very determined French team at home in France to win the fifth Fed Cup title in 6 years. That's certainly something that I would take with me. And also Dominika Sabalkova's newfound mental strength. Really, if you're looking for a clean narrative in 2016, I don't think you can find a cleaner one than Sabalkova, a player who always did great under the radar. And so to see her struggle early in the season was worrisome. But then to see her not only kind of overcome that, but become a really good front runner in Singapore to qualify under the wire and play a really great match against Svetlana Kuznetsova and then play really comprehensive tennis against Kerber in the final with really no hiccups to speak of in that match, in that throughout that whole week played five really great matches, for better or for worse. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing how she can continue to carry that into 2017. And what would I want to leave?
Leave it behind. Let it go.
Yeah, I don't know what I would leave. I guess just injuries. Injuries, crazy headlines. I would like to leave those in 2016. I don't really want to have to. I would really like to just talk about the tennis in 2017. And I don't really. I think a lot of that other stuff was very distracting and was ultimately something that is very difficult to cover because in a sport that can be, that has so many personalities and is therefore so subjective in many ways, I think it's difficult to cover those sorts of headlines. And so I think if the more we can get back to forehands and backhands, the more we can get back to rivalries and on-court results, I think we'll all be a lot happier in 2017 to kind of stick to keep it all on the court, as it were. Oh, and I'd also like to leave doubles partner splitting in 2016.
You want them all to stay together forever?
All stay together. That's my theme. I have very bad abandonment issues, apparently, because I don't want anybody to split up. I want everybody to stay together.
And that's a wrap on this episode of the WTA Insider Podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or on any podcast app of your choice to ensure you never miss an episode when they go live. Reviews are always helpful, so if you like what you've heard so far, please do leave us one. And you can also get new episode alerts by following us on Twitter at WTA_insider. And we'll, of course, post the podcast on the WTA website at WTATennis.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.